Hello and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere, which hopefully you've heard of. But if not, Blogosphere is a media company rooted in the world of influencers. We run events, an influencer network, and publish a nationally distributed print magazine, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @BlogosphereM. And if you want to learn more about influencers and the influencer industry, be sure to visit blogosphere magazine.com and invest in a subscription to our essential magazine. We're excited to announce that Series 1 of Serious Influence has an exclusive sponsor, the smart thinking money app, Yolt. Yolt is an app that I personally use, so I'm delighted to partner with them. You can sync your accounts, credit cards, and pensions in one view and track your spending habits, how much you're spending and what you're spending it on. I buy a lot of coffee. Yolt takes the stress out of budgeting and gives you the tools to achieve your financial life goals. For me, that's a trip to French Polynesia. Download Yolt for free from the App Store or Google Play Store today. Today on Blogosphere's Serious Influence, I'm joined by Nick Yeals. Nick is the co-founder and CEO of Peg, a technology platform that streamlines all aspects of influencer marketing, from selecting which influencers to work with, all the way to reporting on the return on investment of a campaign. Nick has been involved in the influencer industry since 2012, when he worked for Simon Cowell's company, Psycho, producing content for YouTube.
I got headhunted by Simon Cowell's execs to help essentially direct and produce a new show that they were doing exclusively on YouTube. And when we launched that show, we had the dream ingredients in that we had arguably the biggest man in entertainment behind it at the time, being Simon. Google were funding it and helping us with it. Our sponsors were Microsoft and Unilever, and we had access to the biggest A-list celebrities in the world appearing on our channel. We launched the show, and it started really well, and then was a complete flop. And we're like, oh dear, how do we fix this? So at that point in time, I was basically having dinner with the talent manager for one of the biggest influencers at the time. And I said to her, how would your client like to interview Kelly Rowland? And I thought at the time, bear in mind, so we started this back in 2012, so it's a while ago now. And to my surprise, she turned around and went, my client's not effing interviewing Kelly Rowland. My client's effing bigger than Kelly Rowland. And I was like, whoa, okay, wasn't expecting that.
How had you cultivated those relationships with talent management at that time? When did you first kind of stumble across the world? Was it because of the stuff you were posting?
No, I think it was because, so actually the show that we were doing for Psycho Entertainment, which is Simon Cowell's company, was my first venture into this whole crazy world. So my background was I used to create a lot of digital content. So they found me because they spotted a video that I directed for Skrillex. But this was the first time I was brought into this world. And how we started making those connections, I think that was via Google actually, because we were one of the Google original programming schemes. So I think they helped us with some introductions there.
So that was before you were at Psycho, that you got the relationship with Google?
No, during Psycho. Okay. Yeah, because they had funded the project that I was then working on.
How many other projects were going on at the same time?
That Google had funded?
Yeah.
I believe it was something like 200 projects at the time, and then I think they upped it to something like 300.
And so this talent agent says, my client is effing bigger than Kelly Rowland. And you think, oh.
Sat in the airport the next day and thought about it and thought, you know what? She's absolutely right. On YouTube, Simon Cowell is no one. Kelly Rowland is no one. We were no one. We didn't own our audience, whereas these creators did. And so we thought, okay, we've got to find a way that we can work with them better. And we had gone about this in a very, I think, a very arrogant way, in that we had come into this industry completely fresh. And we had effectively said, we're Psycho Entertainment. We're Sony Music. You know, you should appear on our channel. And actually what we decided to do was say, actually, let's go in at the same level and just approach it in the same way that creators do. We say, let's create two videos together, one that sits on our channel, one that sits on your channel, and we'll cross-promote to each other. When we implemented that strategy, it then became the fastest growing YouTube channel in the world overnight.
Wow.
And it was incredible looking at the stats and seeing that when we'd work with traditional A-list celebrities, we'd see little to no impact on the stats at all. When we'd work with a YouTube influencer, we'd see these huge, crazy spikes. And so putting two and two together with my background from the marketing world, I suddenly realized, okay, these guys are going to have a huge impact on just about every multi-billion dollar industry that there is out there, whether that's film, TV, music, advertising, modeling, you name it. But the whole process of how you identified them, contacted them, that whole thing, it was just such a nightmare that I thought there had to be some software that would streamline this whole process. And that's when we went on the venture to build Peg.
And so which influencers were you working with cross-promoting on the channels?
At that time, we were working with basically all of the biggest UK influencers, actually, and a lot of the big American ones. So Zoella, Alfie Days, Tanya Burr, Jim Chapman, Marcus Butler. In America, we were working with the likes of Candy Johnson, Epic Mealtime, et cetera, et cetera.
And so you thought there's an opportunity to streamline the selecting process here to build it with software.
Mm-hmm.
So then what happened?
So that project, which was called U-Generation, ran for a year, and it was almost an experiment for Psycho in a way to see what was the world of digital like. After that, I had the idea for Peg, but thought if I'm going to build a tech company, I need to know how to code. So I went on a 3-month coding boot camp to learn how to code. And literally day one after that boot camp, I started building Peg.
And what year are we in now then? When this
2014.
And how has the influencer industry evolved during your time from starting a business?
Ooh, there's a lot. So one, when I first started coming into this industry, influencer was still very much this sort of interesting gimmick on the side. And people were interested, but no one wanted to own it. So if you look at, say, for example, the agencies, you had PR agencies, media agencies, creative agencies. Everyone was kind of like, nah, that doesn't really sit with us. Now it's flipped and everyone's saying it sits with us and they want to own it. We've seen a lot more brands and agencies now invest heavily in taking this in-house. And there have been some major industry trends that have happened. For example, there's been a big shift away from YouTube towards Instagram being the preferred platform, which I highly disagree with.
Is Peg YouTube only or no?
No. So
but was it at one point in that evolved?
It very much started as YouTube only, and we definitely have a skew towards YouTube because I have a very, very strong preference for that, which I can go into.
Yeah, well, why do you have a preference for?
Fundamentally, what you are doing with influencer marketing, it's just the same as any other form of marketing. You're trying to affect the way that someone thinks, feels, or behaves. It's no coincidence that in the traditional advertising world, TV has been the king of advertising for decades. Because if you truly want to affect someone, if you can tell a story, you're much more likely to be able to do that. And so traditionally, particularly where Instagram was purely photography and YouTube was longer form video, that was a much better platform to be able to truly affect people on. But then there are many other aspects to it as well. For example, the platform is just much more mature in terms of the kind of data that's accessible and available. Things like if you truly care about tracking things like links, Instagram is still very basic in terms of if you want to include link tracking, yes, you've got swipe ups from stories and stuff like that, but it's incredibly limited. One of the most powerful things that you can tap into, I think, with social media is the long tail effect, where any other form of advertising, you're used to buying a window in time. So if you're doing a TV advert, you buy a specific window. If you buy into a magazine, you buy a specific page, for example, for that issue. Whereas with, say, YouTube, you have this incredible advantage that it can sit there forever and it's a search engine. So people can keep coming back again and again and again, and you get that long tail effect. Whereas with something like Instagram Stories, you're going straight back to the old model of buying into, say, a 24-hour window.
Do you think that YouTube as a platform is doing enough in terms of search functionality to promote its creators?
I don't know if I'm the best qualified person to answer that. My take on it would be, for sure, there are all sorts of decisions that they make that I can see are incredibly frustrating for creators. But also, I do think we have to be fair to them that if you take a step back and look at actually what are all the other platforms doing, I still think YouTube is far and away the most advanced at what they've done to help creators. So I can definitely see how it's starting to shift towards them favoring companies. But I'm also, I guess being a business owner myself, I'm acutely aware of that things can look bad from the outside, when actually when you're running the company from the inside, you're doing it with absolutely the best intentions. So I don't look badly at YouTube.
In terms of your business and how it works and those relationships that you have, do you have direct relationships with brands and influencers? Are you selling your software to brands and therefore your focus needs to be more on brands?
It sort of shifts back and forth between the two. Ultimately, at the end of the day, we are providing a service for both sides.
The influencer has the capacity to be searched and the brand has the capacity to search and then report. Do you actually administer deals through the platform as well, or is it just more facilitating?
It's more facilitating. So we don't get involved with the deal itself. You could almost think of us in this sense a little bit like a LinkedIn for influencers. So the brand can identify and find the right people and then they can contact them. And we're not going to step in and say, oh, no, now you have to pay us a big percentage.
They can contact them through your platform. So you have messaging functionality.
Exactly, yeah. And so one of the big things that we do is we partner with the major talent managers. So then that's another thing that we actually highly recommend is that you generally work with talent who have talent management. And so we create partnerships with them so that when you go to contact one of the influencers, it actually goes through to their manager.
Why do you recommend that they should have talent management? Is that just the kind of caliber of influencer that is on your platform? Is it micro-influencer all the way through to macro, or is it the macro levels who are more inclined to have management? Or the mid, you know, quite a few people do have management now.
So you can find anyone on Peg. Literally, you can search by any name and they will appear and you can see their profile.
And how are they on your platform?
So it's a mixture of, one, the technology that we've built, that we have built databases so that you can search for people in the database. We've also built mechanics so if they're not in the database, it will go directly to YouTube and Instagram to find them and create a profile in real time.
So with the database, it's people that are actually signing up. And with the technology and mechanics, that is sourcing the APIs of the social platforms and onboarding talent that way, which creates an automatic profile. So how many people do you have on your site?
There's actually more stages to it. So right. So yes, there are the influencers who have signed up. But then we also have a database where every single day we're adding new influencers to it and collecting data to profile them.
What sort of data do you collect?
So there's the obvious basic things of course, engagement, views, stuff like that, the content. But then there's much more advanced things that we do. So, for example, we go through all of their content and we look for things like, have they worked with brands before? So we can detect if they've worked with them. And we can see...
How can you detect?
Basically advanced language analysis. So we can also detect if they're mentioning brands, but they are not specifically working with them. So there's all sorts of terms that you're looking for to try and decipher between the two. But then we can even see things like, are they brand safe? So do they swear frequently or do they use controversial language? Do they appear in the press? If they appear in the press, is the sentiment of that press positive or negative?
Probably negative with influencers.
Well,
what is positive?
Most of the time, I'd say it's pretty positive.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm hoping that Joe Sugg will change mainstream press. For
yeah. So yeah, there's all sorts of things like that. We can see things like backlash detection. So have they had a video or a series of videos that have been reacted to particularly badly by their audience? And then that should be a flag to a brand if they're going to work with them. So, for example, the Logan Paul scandal, we detected that straight away because we could instantly see this huge drop or spike in the data, a negative spike in the data of a backlash from his audience. So there's all sorts of things like that.
When you are detecting whether an influencer is brand safe, do you cross-reference that information depending on what brand it is? Because surely some influencers must be brand safe for one brand, but not for another?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. What we do instead is we say, here's the data and you can make a judgment yourself on it. So if, for example, someone swears a lot, we're not necessarily saying that's a bad thing. We're just saying you should be aware of this. And actually, if you're a really edgy brand, maybe you don't care about that. Whereas if you're Disney, you probably do. So we leave it up to the brand to decide.
And how many brands have you got kind of using the platform at the moment?
So we've got last time I checked, it was over 1,700 across 169 countries.
And how many influencers have you got, roughly?
In terms of the ones who have actively signed up?
Or no, well, both.
So in terms of the ones that you can search and profile and so on, that is literally infinite, like I mentioned, because you can search whoever. Mm. In terms of,
do you have a number for it, though? Because how many influencers really are there in the world? I was looking at a stat earlier, and it was saying that there are 5.7% of Instagram's users have over 10,000 followers, which would be 57 million.
Yeah, that's quite a lot.
Yeah, that is a lot.
Yeah.
Do you think that's right? I mean, obviously not all of those will be digital-first talent.
Yeah. So I think that is a very important point, because what we actually do is, a large part of what's going on behind the scenes with PEG from a technology point of view is we're stripping channels out. So we strip out brands, we strip out non-digital first talent, so like your Kim Kardashians of the world. We strip out people who aren't uploading content anymore, all these kind of things. So you're actually left with a much smaller database that's then cleaner and faster to work through.
Would you strip out a Love Islander?
Personally, yes.
It is a different... I talk about this too much on the podcast, so people are just going to be bored of hearing me say this, though. But it is a different...
I agree. So I get asked this question a lot. Like, how do you define what is an influencer or social influencer? The way that we define it is they have to be digital first. You actually said exactly the same thing, which is great. So what we find is if people have built their audience off the back of another medium like TV, radio... often their audiences aren't engaged in the same way and they don't feel they know them in the same way. So that's why they have to be digital first for us.
Do you have any virtual influencers on your platform?
Certainly not that I'm aware of.
What are your views on virtual influencers?
Well...
and maybe we should explain a bit about the movement as well, which is people creating AI influencers, which are then doing brand campaigns. And there has been... some backlash, but I can see for other platforms that are treating influencers and stripping out the human element of this human industry, that it would be easier to control. However, on the flip side of that, an AI influencer has been created by a human, and that human is still going to be asking for the money and doing what the budget is. So I don't know.
I think people have to ask themselves why they're actually interested in this industry in the first place. So for me, where it all stems from is back to when I was 12 and I was making videos. I desperately wanted to be a film director. And I thought, if only someone could give me the budget, I'd prove to them that I could create something amazing. And the industry at that time and in the past had been entirely dominated by white middle-class males. I mean, don't get me wrong, I am a white middle-class male. but my point being, it was this very small, finite group of people who decided our entire industry and what we were allowed to watch and view and listen to and everything. And what I really loved about when I got into the creator space was, wow, finally, there is a way that anyone from anywhere, any background, any race, any gender, can create whatever they want. And so the kind of topics I'd always been interested in were never the mainstream topics. I don't like things like football or Love Island or whatever. I love things like skateboarding, snowboarding, economics, computer science. And the TV industry and the traditional media industries had never really catered for them because it wasn't mainstream enough. So I loved the fact that here I could finally get hold of that content. And then that was something that I wanted to really help encourage and say, how can we try and build an industry that enables these guys to create more amazing content? So I'm not necessarily saying virtual influencers are a terrible thing, but for me, I'm like, oh, guys, why are we spending time on this? Like, surely there's more interesting things that we could be doing here. It's related to what I think is almost a bigger problem if we take a step back, which is people creating channels for the purpose of influence. I think that's the wrong way to go about it. I think what's amazing about this industry is that people can create the kind of content that they're interested in. And there are other individuals who can say, I really relate to that person. I love what they're doing. I really respect them and relate to them. And so if they recommend to me, oh, you know what? I actually really believe in this brand because I think they're doing something really interesting. That they'll say, okay, I'm interested. Like, I'll check that out. I think what's a problem with the industry now is that there are way too many people saying, I want to be an influencer. they're going into it for the very reason to influence, which I think is the wrong way of looking at it. And actually, creating a virtual influencer is like the extreme version of that.
Also, by default, a virtual influencer doing a sponsored campaign or talking about a brand doesn't have the power to say something negative. So therefore, their positive review is the only thing they can do. So it's not as impactful. Yeah. The whole being human and not liking things, you know, it's kind of supply and demand, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. We talked a bit about money kind of coming in to the industry and investing in this space. What do you think about the kind of companies that have launched in your tenure of being a business owner? Because we've seen a lot of influencer companies set up in the last 2 years, specifically maybe 18 months. There's a lot of money around, but what's happening to it?
As in literally, where is the investment money being spent? Or
yeah, and do you think there's too many companies now launching? Are there too many talent management? Is it too many brand and influencer connectors taking a commission? You know, some of these margins are pretty huge.
I don't believe there's too many talent management companies. I think that's only going to grow, and I think that's actually a good thing, because as I said earlier, I do think it's actually important that people have representation.
What do you think that their role is as well? Because I think it used to all be about sorting out the brand deals and doing that, but as you mentioned, lots of people can bring that in-house now. So would you say it's more about strategy and future-proofing?
The talent managers themselves.
For
their talent. So they're called talent managers. And so I view them just the same as any manager in a business, which is them saying, okay, this is where you are right now. Where do you want to get to? I'll help you get to that point. And so whether that be helping them create a strategy to get there, whether it be helping them with connections, moving them with all the roadblocks and hurdles, and allow the creators to do what they do best, focus on creating. Don't get caught up in things like contracts, which they don't know about and probably shouldn't really know all that much about, and leave them to do what they do best.
Yeah.
You seem like you disagree.
No, I don't disagree. I think that sometimes there can be a barrier created in terms of feedback on branded work, where even if it's for good purposes to maybe protect the talent, they're not hearing about when things go wrong. When you don't hear about when things go wrong and people aren't happy, then it can't really mature in quite the same way.
But I would say that's more bad management as opposed to the profession being a bad thing to have.
Yeah. So what do you think about the connective platforms that are taking commissions? Do you think there'll be some consolidation? And what is also 100%. Happening with Facebook and their influencer platform that's coming over?
So in terms of the different platforms, 100% there's going to be consolidation. What we're seeing is just the same as any new industry. There's a flood of companies that come in. One of the challenges, but also opportunities in a way with our industry, is that there's a very low barrier to entry. So there are an awful lot of companies cropping up who have no previous background in this whatsoever, but they saw an opportunity and they thought, we'll go for it. Naturally, a lot of them are going to die out, and that is happening now. And you'll have a few that start to emerge, and eventually there will highly likely be a winner takes all. I'm not going to speak badly about a specific platform. Don't get me wrong, there's a lot of good stuff out there. But I would say as a category, the one that I'm most worried about are influencer marketplaces. So the kind of platforms that allow brands to sign up, influencers to sign up, the brand can put out a brief and say, hey, I'll pay someone $200 if they do this, and the influencer can apply for it. I think they have the risk or the potential to be the ones who destroy this entire industry.
Why?
Because the main thing is that what this entire industry is built on is the trust between an influencer and their audience. What these marketplaces do are effectively try to encourage as many sales, as many deals as possible. So it doesn't have to be a good fit between the brand and the influencer. And there's an amazing case study of this by a guy called Mark Ritson, who's a famous marketeer in the UK. And he wanted to put this to the test to show how badly this was destroying the authenticity of influencer marketing. And so he uploaded this picture and sent it to, I think it was 18 influencers, and gave them 24 hours. And he would pay them to say, this is one of the best pieces of artwork I've ever seen. More than half of them did it within 24 hours. And what they didn't realize was it was a photo of his ass. And it was just to prove the point of, look at how these guys have no care whatsoever about their audience and the credibility of the brands that they work with. But the other bigger problem on a macro scale that I think they do is that I think one of my perhaps slightly more controversial views on this space is that I think we have to drastically increase the prices that influencers can charge. The reason for that is because if you're a CMO and you have a budget of, say, $100 million, based on industry averages at the moment, 36 or 37 million of that would go towards TV advertising. 35 million would go towards digital, 8 million towards newspapers, et cetera, et cetera. And then what happens with the influencer marketplaces is they say you can start your campaign from $100, which seems great on the surface, but what that's doing is actually pushing prices down. Because like any marketplace, imagine you're buying something on eBay. Let's say it's a TV. You got two TVs that are exactly the same. One's cheaper than the other. You're going to go for the cheaper one. So it becomes a race to the bottom and pushes prices down. The same is now happening in the influencer industry because we're basing these prices on things like cost per engagement or CPE. And if you can say, I got these two influencers who give me the same engagement rates, but one is cheaper, I'm going to go for the cheaper one. And so what happens if you think back to that pie chart of the CMO, the influencer piece of the pie is becoming smaller and smaller and smaller. And then it means they're never going to put the best teams on it and the best minds on it and the best resources to make sure that these campaigns are a success. And it means we're never going to get it off the ground and make it a serious piece of the advertising pie.
When it's also based on scale, there is no incentive to actually vet the influencers mm-hmm. signed up to your platform.
Yeah, exactly. If we look at three of the biggest trends that have happened in this industry over the last few years, since I've got into it, there's been the shift from YouTube to Instagram. I touched on a little bit what I thought the problems were with that were. There's been the shift towards CPE being the main metric for success. And there's been a shift from macro influencers to micro influencers. All of these trends, I believe, are having a negative impact on the industry. So say, for example, micro influencers. What these platforms allow and encourage is that anyone pretty early on can sign up to one of these platforms and start being paid straight away. This is fueling the whole fraud issue because people can go and buy 10,000 followers and suddenly they're being paid for this work.
In terms of what I've been hearing from agencies is that, yes, there was a big push. I believe actually Group M has a section that is all about guaranteed engagements as well. Mm. And that's something that they operate within the marketing, influencer marketing space. Mm. But now what I'm hearing with agencies is that they did move towards the micro-influencer, but now they're thinking about it more strategically. And so that a campaign will have the micro-influencer level for noise and to own a space at a specific time, but for the macro influencer and mid-tier to be really changing that brand sentiment. Mm-hmm. What do you think is the main beneficial result and return on investment that influencer marketing can offer? And do you think that brands should be looking at this industry to change brand sentiment or to push sales or an amalgamation?
Mm. So I think this industry almost exclusively seems to focus on influencer marketing as brand awareness. I strongly believe we need to get a lot better at looking at it as a form of performance marketing. So if you look at the sort of traditional customer funnel, customer journey from awareness, consideration, action, most people are focused at the top and they're saying, oh, we worked with these influencers and we got this many eyeballs. Now, if all you care about is eyeballs, influencer marketing is actually an incredibly tedious way of doing that. There's way easier ways of buying media and getting eyeballs that's a lot less complicated. I think where influencers really come into their own is if you try and drive bottom of the funnel metrics. So actually hard business metrics like revenue, ROI, downloads, stuff like that.
Which isn't, though, trackable on kind of lots of forms of social media, which is why YouTube would be good in that respect.
If you have a way, a digital way of buying your product, so be that an e-commerce store or be it that you have an app to download, then it's all trackable with trackable links. The trick then is more, how do you incentivize people to click that link and to click it with urgency? The actual tracking aspect isn't complicated, and it's what the digital marketing industry has been doing for years. So we have to get a lot better at that side of things.
Why are people not doing that? I mean, surely as a brand, if you want to, you know, and they do want to see, actually, it's not just, oh, we're doing a bit of that, that's a beautiful piece of creative. They want to know hard facts. And surely that would be a great way to start tracking.
So I think it is happening in certain industries. So first of all, the majority of the people who are running this industry, be it platforms, talent management companies, the agencies, they've all come from various different backgrounds. And most of them don't come from highly analytical digital tracking backgrounds. And so the reality is, I think they just don't know how to do this. And to be completely frank, before fairly recently, I wasn't familiar with this stuff either. It just wasn't really on my radar. It was only when we started thinking, hold on, we've got to try and solve this problem, that we started really looking into it and saying, hold on, this has been done for years in the digital marketing space. So I think the main thing is people just aren't really aware of it. I think where people are really good at it are in companies that we describe as, we call them DMSs, digitally minded scale-ups. So digitally minded, what I mean by that is they have some kind of digital way of tracking their product. So as I say, like an app or e-commerce store, they tend to be very, very savvy and sophisticated about how they think about tracking and measuring ROI. And the scale-up piece, that these often fairly young companies, so maybe they've raised somewhere between like $1 and $50 million, they are under this pressure from their investors to grow very fast. So once they've found a growth driver that really works for them, they pump so much money into it and they grow incredibly rapidly. Whereas the very big traditional brands and the very big traditional agencies don't have the same pressure to track that stuff, because they have these huge above-the-line advertising budgets that they can see this as a tick box in their campaign and say, yeah, that was a success because this many people saw it. Whereas these scale-ups live and die by, can they measure the ROI? So they have to be much more sophisticated about it. So if you look at things like the mobile gaming industry, they are unbelievably advanced with this stuff.
In terms of digital-minded scale-ups, do you think that we're seeing many in the UK? I mean, you've just talked about budgets, but they sound very US-based. And do you think there's been a bit of a fallout sort of in venture capital in the UK because there were so many companies that did start up that got investment and that weren't actually really passionate about the space and that are just moving into it very quickly and fucking it up for everyone?
Do you mean in terms of investment going into influencer-related companies?
Yes.
So two parts. In terms of, are there enough digital-minded scale-ups in the UK? Yeah, for sure. There's tons of these companies and we're working with a load of them now. And they're incredibly interesting, fascinating companies. In terms of investment in the influencer space, I think that's really dried up because there was a lot of hype and interest a few years ago. But there's been such a flood of companies coming into this now. And what they're really struggling to do is actually prove that they can, one, become profitable, self-sustaining businesses, but also that they can actually deliver really successful campaigns. And so that second round of funding is becoming a lot harder, I believe.
When brands, you know, things have kind of dried up, but more brands are looking into working. I think the statistic is 67% of brands want to increase their influencer marketing spend. Mm. Now, you're offering search functionality, but also reporting. How do they want things to be reported on? Mm. How do you sign up a brand? Is that all manual? Do you have a sales team? What's the inside of Peg look like?
Mm. So the first part to it in terms of reporting, it really differs depending on the kind of company. So in the past, we were more focused on building tools for the likes of the agencies and the big brands. There, the reporting is fairly basic stuff in terms of who viewed this piece of content, what was the audience, and then actually allowing nifty tools like click this button and you can export it to a PowerPoint presentation so you can show your boss or your client very easily. On the digital-minded scale-ups, they are much, much more analytically driven. So what they want to know is, if I spent a pound on this influencer, how many pounds did I get back? And so they have to really understand, how does this connect to all my other tools, my Google Analytics, my Shopify, and everything like that?
How does the PEG team work? You're founder, co-founder, CEO?
Yeah. So we have the team split into three. So we have growth, product, and operations. So in the product team, we have the developers, the designers. In the growth team, we have sales, marketing, and the team that delivers on campaigns.
Where do you see the future of PEG, and what is your mission as a whole?
So the future of PEG and our mission is, so we think a lot about what we call the influence economy, which involves the three major stakeholders. So the creators who are making the content, the brands who are funding that content, and the audience who are watching that content. And we think if you can get a great balance between all three of those, we can create something really amazing and powerful because for everyone, because we can create effectively a world where creators can be paid to create the kind of content that they want and make a decent living from it without having to do tons of brand deals, but actually just do a few number of very meaningful partnerships with brands they really believe in. Brands can have an incredibly powerful way of reaching new customers and growing in meaningful ways. And audiences can get the kind of content that they want to watch, but in a way where you're not slapped in the face with an advert that you don't want to watch. You're actually choosing to watch a collaboration with a brand and a creator because you're a fan of both of them. So we believe what's at the heart of all of that is influencing with integrity. And so because there are values, our mission is to try and be the number one platform in the world that powers influencer marketing.
Do you think that we can have, we've mentioned so many of the pain points in this industry and problems. Do you think that we can have AI solutions to them all? Or do you think that there always needs to be a human touch? And I know that we touched upon earlier fake followers and people and, you know, the platforms indexing value against followers or engagement rates, so people buying those. But what also hasn't been mentioned is people can buy them for other people that they don't like. So, you know, it may flag to some AI, oh, this person's fraudulent, but actually they've really carefully curated their whole career. And then somebody that's envious of them just pops 10,000 followers on and then they're blacklisted. What do you think about that, these AI solutions to all of your problems?
I think AI is one of the most bandied around words in quite a dangerous way. I think it's an incredibly powerful tool if used well. And yes, there is a lot of PEG that is powered by AI, but we don't talk about it anywhere. I actually think it's quite a lazy marketer's way of talking about a company. If you look at companies like Google, for example, take a product like Google Photos, incredible product. It's entirely powered by AI and machine learning, but they don't mention it anywhere. They talk about it sorts your photos better and stuff like that. I think what a lot of companies do in this industry is they say, our platform is powered by IBM Watson. And people buy into that. And then you say, oh, and so what does that mean? How does that help you? And then they don't know. So I think it's very easy to ban that word around without people really knowing what it means.
If someone were to say IBM Watson,
IBM Watson, as far as I understand, and I don't know a huge amount about it, I believe that they have built a machine learning library that you can basically plug your database into to make it perform operations, for example, process your data in certain ways without you having to build the machine learning models, if that means anything at all.
Not really.
Basically, it's a way of using machine learning techniques without you having to build it yourself.
Right. Do you think there's a place for blockchain within the influencer industry as another good old term?
So I think blockchain, similar to AI, is an incredibly important technology that is fundamentally going to have a huge impact on not just this industry, but every industry. I think it is too early at the moment. And I think there are so many basics of this industry that we haven't cracked yet. And it's like learning to walk before you can run. I think it's way too early to try and apply things like blockchain.
And then finally, what's your worst experience that you've had in the influencer space?
I don't think there's a specific bad story that's happened in the influencer space. It's more the slow, gradual shift that's happened in the industry. So the explosion of these influencer marketplaces, which I feel like, as I said, are having very, very negative impacts on all sorts of areas of the industry.
Do you think they could actually destroy, full stop, the industry?
I do, yeah. Because I think what it only takes enough marketers to try influencer marketing, have a bad experience that they say, I'm never going to put money in that again. If they stop putting money into it, there is no industry anymore. It's the gradual shift to those. It's the gradual shift to Instagram. It's the focus on CPE. It's the shift towards micro-influencers. It's this kind of collection of all of these things that I think are bad practices that seem, on the surface, seem very, very rational and make sense. But actually, if you really think deeply about it and look at it from a macro perspective, you realize this is a terrible thing for the industry. And that has made our lives a lot harder because everything that we've built the platform on has been based on what we believe to be the best practices. And that's not always necessarily what the industry wants.
Who is in a position to be able to vocalize this before it's too late? How can we implement change? From all the people listening to this podcast.
Well, of course. So I don't believe that there is a single strong enough voice in this industry to have that much of an effect. I think it's more about as many influential voices as possible starting to cotton on to this stuff. I think there are a few key players. I think the likes of John and Hank Green are two of my absolute heroes in this industry that I do think have a lot of sway. But I don't think them alone can do it. I think we all have to try and wake up to it.
A big thanks to Nick for coming on the show. You've been listening to Blogosphere, Serious Influence, with me, Alice Audley. Be sure to check out blogosphere magazine.com for influencer industry updates. And why not treat yourself to a magazine subscription whilst you're there?